Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network in Environmental Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm Matt Brown, a host of the channel, and I'm currently an MA candidate at the University of Wyoming studying cultural history focused on environment and science. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Renee Hansen about her new book, Watershed, Attending to the Body and Earth in Distressed, published by University of Minnesota Press in 2021. Dr. Renee Hansen, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here with you, Matt.
Well, thank you for coming on. I'm excited to talk about your book. But before we actually dive into this insightful, powerful book, I wanted to ask if you could begin by telling us a bit about your background and your bio.
Sure. Oh, it's always interesting what you have to pick when you decide to describe yourself. I'm a Minnesotan, very much a Minnesotan, who's going to transplant myself somehow in a month to Seattle because my kids all moved to the West Coast. But I'll always be a Minnesotan. I was born in Bemidji, which is northwest Minnesota, grew up in northeastern Minnesota, and then taught for 40 years or something in the Twin Cities. I have been in Wyoming some and even stayed there about a week, but I haven't been there much. I grew up canoeing in the Boundary Waters because as I look out right now, I'm back here at the lake and we're right at the start of the wilderness, the biggest wilderness area in continental U.S., I believe. But we backpacked and canoed because it was just what you do when you live on the water. We pretty much lived out of the woods when I was growing up in our garden. And then I went out into the world and found out something about it. I thought everybody lived like this, kind of canning their own corn for the winter. And I'm 71, so like, it was a long time ago for most of you, but I thought it was just normal to live in the woods. And then I found out that isn't how the rest of the world lived, even then. That was kind of a shock to me. I did go into academic life and get my doctorate and teach at Minneapolis College for most of my career, taught at a number of other places too. But that was a great place because, like the woods, it was very diverse. When I'm up here in the woods, there are lots of beings, different kinds of beings to be with. But then when I was in the, academic world, it seemed like there was only a few kinds of beings. But at Minneapolis College, we had a great variety of people, not so many other beings. But a lot of climate refugees, a lot of native-born diverse groups. This is a very diverse college. And I was at home there. But I became increasingly concerned about climate change because of the stories from my students and because of what I was watching happen to my North Woods here. We're at the very center of the continent, and you probably know that heats up quicker than the edges. And it has been doing that, heating up. We've been losing winter. So I was disturbed about climate change. Then at 64, I suddenly lost my beta cells and became type 1 diabetic. A great surprise to me. Didn't know you could do that when you were old, but I did. And I'm now a diabetic on an insulin pump and had to learn all about diabetes and carbohydrates. I didn't know what carbohydrates were, but I gradually realized they were rather like carbon. And when I got sick, I was way over the top with carbohydrates, just like the earth is over the top with CO2. So I began to make the connections between what happened to my body and what was happening to the earth. And that actually gave me a way into talking and working on ecological issues. Matt, does that somewhat describe who I am?
I mean, it hits all of the points in your book, I think. We've only known each other for about, I would say, 10 minutes or so, but it sounds good to me. Thank you so much for that.
Sure.
And I mean, just kind of moving on to the book, it's written in such a creative way with little meditations interspersed throughout. The chapters are super unique in terms of like their titles, and then also the way that you narrate them and even you compose them. But I like, before we really get into that, like, could you tell me just like where you got the idea to write it, or what was the motivation to write it? And I don't know, just something along that lines.
Yeah. I wrote earlier in my career, and then I was a single mother and I was teaching at a community college, which means you're working all the time. And also my students' voices, I realized, they seemed to me to be much more important than mine as a white Minnesota woman who, people hear from us, but you don't hear so much from a new Somali immigrant or from someone who just managed to get here from Mexico or El Salvador or Tibet or wherever. My students came from all over, a lot of refugees from places like Florida and Alaska and Chicago too, refugees for many different reasons. I was teaching writing and global studies and what was at the time called ecofeminism. And my students' voices seemed like worth laying my life on the line for. So I was really working hard on getting them out into the world and established so they could write. Gradually, some students started coming to me saying, tell our stories. You've got some privilege we don't have, privilege of audience. And I realized I did have some privilege of audience that would take them a long time to get, and that the stories that they were giving me were so incredibly precious. Everybody should be able to read all this stuff that I got to read from my students. So that was one major motivation for writing. Another one is that I'm a member of many diverse groups. I'm, as I've already said, really a Minnesotan, and my family group is a lovely kind of like clan of fundamentalist Christians. It's sort of weird, I mean, fringy, interesting. My city people are really diverse, of diverse religions, diverse colors, diverse all kinds of things. And that's become the community I'm most at home in. My hometown is a mining town in the middle of an area where a lot of people are wilderness outfitters and the like. But my town, they're miners. And these groups don't know each other and don't talk to each other and are pretty much afraid of and tend to stereotype one another. My climate refugee students from Somalia, for example, know almost nothing about the water in Minnesota. It seems like there's plenty of it to them, so there's no problems. And then they gradually learn that there are actually water problems here too, and they need to pay attention because this is their new home. But they don't know the trees here. They don't understand why winter is important. It felt like a lot of people needed to learn about a lot of other people, not only the humans, but the trees and the four-leggeds. And I wanted a gentle way of introducing them to each other. And then the diabetes came kind of as a gift to give me, I think, a way in of talking about that community, because I had suddenly lost one of my internal communities. If you've got working beta cells, folks, thank them now again. You probably don't ever think about them, but they are amazing. What they can do is to notice what you eat and give you the right amount of insulin at the right moment. I tell you, it's really hard to figure it out once they croak on you. So we are each a community of varied beings, and we got to work together to keep that body functioning. And then that's very like the community we are here in the outside of the personal body world. So I wanted to write about that. And I also am a cross-disciplinary person. I never fit very well into one academic discipline, partly because I think we have to keep crossing borders. So the book does that. It's not exactly memoir. It's maybe memoir of Minnesota watersheds. It's storytelling, and it is meditation sometimes. Once I freed myself from thinking it had to be one thing or the other, it really got easier to write. I think that's enough answer for now.
That's so powerful. And I mean, the fact that all of the things that you went through with the diabetes, that a lot of that is at the end of the book, and to be able to turn around and say that that's a gift is something that I don't know if I have the strength to do. But it's really amazing that you're able to do that and then tie it into these greater narratives and your greater experiences. And I kind of would like to start in your childhood though, and just kind of like, I guess, ask you a two-part question. One, at the very beginning, you do make a land acknowledgement to the indigenous people whose land you either grew up on or you taught. So I wanted to open the door and ask you to talk a little bit about that. And then also, I wanted to ask you just in especially the first couple of chapters as you're growing up, you really foreshadow climate change. But you don't necessarily, as you said, you weren't necessarily aware of it. So I just kind of wanted to like maybe ask you about that and then that transition into learning more about it as you got older and maybe saw the world more.
Yeah. Thank you for noting the original people here. I've noted that our Dakota went to Wyoming. So you've inherited some of the wisdom of that the people brought from here. This was, well, I wasn't taught that there had been Native people here before as I was growing up. It wasn't something they taught us in school, even though I was born and was in my early life very much near Ojibwa towns. I fished in Red Lake Reservation, and there were Native people around, but it was like a hidden open secret. And I hope that on reading the book, maybe it would take a second reading, you begin to notice how, there were the Ojibwa people, Anishinaabe people there. And I saw them and I kind of noticed, but it was kind of hushed. So I am currently on Ojibwa land. This is ceded territory of the Ojibwa where I am on Birch Lake that flows into the Kuishwa River. The college I taught on is Dakota land, which was never ceded and is never paid for, down by the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi River. And I have learned much from this land and the people who cared for it and are caring for it. And with them, I have learned much. I found that what I had learned from the woods and waters and other beings of the woods themselves was very like what the Anishinaabe people in particular, first I heard from Winona LaDuc, were saying. And I realized that they had to be right because that's what the woods told me too. So that is a very strong thread, I hope, through the book. And I hope it encourages everybody to go out onto their land and learn from the land. We all come from people who were indigenous to this earth, and we are indigenous to it. And we can learn from those who were indigenous on our own lands, and we can learn to become native if we let ourselves grow into the land. And that's what the native people I know have asked us settler descendants also to do. We got to take care of our home together. And then there was a second part of the question.
Yeah, and kind of what you said really highlights a quote from chapter two that I pulled out. Where you wrote, from the distance of Ohio in graduate school, I saw my earlier life as a natural history museum tableau. We had been living the past. We had been part of nature. We were expected, like that Indian man at the Mississippi headwaters, to fade politely away. And so my question was just based off of your own experience in terms of really getting, being, you know, living on the water, as you like to say, and living in the woods, and see, but like also, there's a part in I think chapter one where your dad tells you, trees clean the air, they take the bad stuff out and put the oxygen in, but then you question where do the trees put the bad stuff. So you do a really good job foreshadowing kind of your glimpses into kind of climate change and pollution. But then you really grow out of it. So I was wondering, or you really grow into seeing the world in a different light. And I was just wondering if you could reflect on that experience.
Yes. I wonder if many children don't have similar experiences of wondering why we're hurting the trees, for example. Don't they matter? In the book, it was when my dad told me not to stand by the gas tank as he was putting gas into the car, because at that time it was leaded. And
right.
I like the smell of lead. Children do, you know, this is why they get lead poisoning. Dad firmly told me to get in the car. And then he told me it was poison and would kill my brain. And so I wanted to know why he was using poison in the car. He said that the trees would take care of it. And that seemed like a real burden on the trees to me. So I remembered that. I was, I don't know, six probably. And it seems like a big part of me thought, well, we should stop then. We shouldn't do that because, well, they're my friends. They're the trees. And I think children often feel that way often about animals that they eat. We ate animals and we knew them as our friends, and that felt like the right way. I mean, it was hard to kill that. Well, I killed the chickens, and that was hard because they were nice chickens, but they had good lives, and then we ate them. And then I was responsible to do something decent with their bodies once they were part of me. I wonder how much many people, even who are very civilized, as children think about these things and whether we could nurture that more so that we kind of stop the harm. I was lucky in that my parents were early readers of Silent Spring and Gaylord Houser, and they became health food fanatics, it was called, and didn't want poison spray on their food. So I did get kind of an early start into noticing the problems that chemical pollution could cause. But we've gone so much further into that world. And now we all are here and have to figure out how to untangle ourselves partially by recognizing that we are part of those trees. Matt, did it make you think of anything you wondered as a child?
It's interesting because I grew up in the mountains, but, you know, I grew up outside of the mountains. I grew up in like a valley community, you know, it's Laramie, Wyoming. And so it's like, I don't necessarily feel as if I grew up like in the wilderness or in the woods. I grew up alongside them, and I never had those same types of sensibilities in terms of like really treating nature necessarily as an equal, or things like that. It's not that, but I mean, at the same time, like we never really did hunt. We did fish. But there were questions that came up, you know, when we caught the fish, but it was never anything that was like super, super long lasting or anything like that. And it's only recently that I've really begun to look at the world in a different light.
But I think those beginning things can help inform how you look at it now.
Certainly, certainly. And I think the other big difference, I was thinking that about this when I was reading, is that we also grew up where land was, you know, public, and it was, you know, state-owned land or federal land. There were fences everywhere. And in your book, you state, you know, how you would just, there wasn't even a concern about going up into Canada, right?
Right. Yeah, not at the first, because we would just canoe anywhere or walk anywhere. It wasn't really true. Like, I realize now that if I had walked in some directions, I would have gotten into mining land, and that was very private.
Certainly.
But I didn't have that sense, because I could walk and canoe as far as I could get, and there wasn't anything to stop me. Which was, yeah, unusual. And then as I grew older, first the Boundary Waters became an official wilderness, and then you had to get permits to go into it. People up here fought that because they liked just being able to go into it. But now mostly I don't know. Many people here are now in favor of it being a protected wilderness. But it was weird because they wanted it just to be their backyard. And gradually we could no longer go into the woods to cut trees for our own fire, which also meant we couldn't clean up the woods. And that's a problem. We just had a huge fire, the Greenwood fire, really close to our place here. And it's largely because there's too much deadwood standing. No, not largely. Largely because of climate change, and we've had a horrible drought. But if we could be going out there taking out the deadwood, the fires wouldn't be as likely. So I've watched restrictions come in to what we could do here, much as the original way back in England at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, when the Enclosure Acts came, and the poor people started starving because they could no longer hunt rabbits on closed land. So this issue of what is public land, what do we share, and what is owned is important. And then it's becoming really important related to water.
Yeah, certainly. And before we really get into kind of that, the water and specifically, I kind of want to take a step back also and think about the political ecology or the political economics of it all that you express, especially when you start taking us into the stories of your students, where they would, you know, you talk about Somalia and how they experienced the drought, and then they chopped down the trees to make charcoal that they could sell in Mogadishu. But in doing that, they were well aware that it would only hurt the land further. Yeah. And it seemed to that kind of process seems to happen in a few different places, as well as other nations coming in to use the land for different means. And it kind of just raised like a question for me about, like, going off of that public land issue, like, what is, like, how do we parse the individual from the communal and then build in the earth and the environment and ecology in this conversation as another body.
And how do we change our consciousness so that we realize that it's really all one thing? I encouraged my students and I encourage the readers to get to know a tree, for example, because I think you think that's a small thing. But if you spend time over a long period of time consistently with one tree, amazing things happen. And I can't tell you what, because it'll be whatever you and your tree learn together. That sounds mystical, but it's actually just sort of real. It's all one thing. You mentioned the Somalia crisis, which I had always heard as tribal warfare. And I just thought, oh, those people in Somalia can't get along with each other, so I guess they deserve a war. That sounds bad, but those were thoughts inside me. The elders who I met made clear that the tribal war began because there was a huge drought and there wasn't enough fodder for the various herds. So they all converged on the same little piece of grass and they were starving. And as the elders said, we're not proud of the fact, but we fought and asked us, what would you do if your children were starving? And I really think that's an important question to ask ahead of time. It's not far from tribal warfare here in my little part of the world when resources get scarce and there's not enough fodder or not enough water to go around. How are we going to deal with that? Because we are really all one water. I mean, it's in us and it's outside of us and it's got a limit. So what do we do about that? Matthew, I want to take an extreme jump and go back to something else. You talked about my diabetes.
Yes, please.
I wanted to know if you ever laughed, because I think parts of that are really funny. Did any of it seem funny to you?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, gosh. I don't remember like bursting out into laughter.
I'll just chuckle.
Yeah, like maybe I don't remember.
It's okay,
so much of it is just it was so powerful and almost overwhelming that I don't know if I was in the right frame of mind to necessarily take it in a lighthearted way. I think it might take
another diabetic who's on an insulin pump to laugh about it, but part of my point is that once you become technologically dependent, that's really tricky. So you're up in the middle of the night talking to the helpline, and they're not very helpful sometimes. Well, the same thing is true of our water once we mess it up. You know, we have to then figure out how to clean it. And that's a technological and chemical problem, just like my body is now. And it's really tricky. And we need the helplines, but we got to learn how to do it. So like I had to learn how to manage my insulin pump 24/7. We got to do also with our water systems and now with our weather systems. So that's the end of my little diversion there.
It's like to complicate that even more, though, like what you talk about when you were going house to house, just trying to ask people about their views on climate. You ran into a Navy veteran who didn't believe in climate change, but knew the currents were changing. And that was a problem and that needed to be dealt with. And that's such an, I don't know if you want to reflect on that particular case, and we'll just even complicate that even more, because it was obviously important enough to put in your book, right?
Well, yes, it was another one that's sort of funny, but
I think I probably laughed at that one.
Okay. Yeah. We were going house to house asking people questions, which is so much better than going there asking them for money. We need to talk to each other more and learn what various opinions are. And as a climate activist, as I was sort of in that role at that moment, I was working with Minnesota350.org and asking about climate change. This guy was so clear that there was no climate change, but then he was sure that the change in the ocean currents was a big problem because his buddies were sending him texts about it. I think you just heard this summer, if you're watching the news, that the Gulf Stream is the weakest it's ever been. And my dear friends in Norway, I don't know how it's going to affect them. It's going to affect us all if the Gulf Stream turns. He's right. It's a big issue, and we should be paying attention. Fortunately, his brother-in-law was in the garage with him, and after we left, his brother-in-law probably talked to him because his brother-in-law had said, I think differently than he did do. I know climate change is an issue. We use different language. In much of Minnesota, we mostly talk about extreme weather events, but we mean the same thing.
Right. And that's the same here in the Rocky Mountains. It's always the big snows or the big frosts or things like that. But I mean, I like one really interesting comparison, I think, between your experiences with diabetes and then kind of looking at our, especially these big climatic changes are these little differences in numbers. So in chapter 4, your dad was recording the temp like religiously and noticed it was getting warmer, but still didn't really. That story itself isn't so much what I'm trying to take away, I guess, but it's more of like the measurement of the temperature and what that means. And then later on, you try to eat a avocado and you think there's like 20 grams of carbohydrates when there's only two. And those measurements seem so benign until they're not, right?
Yeah, I almost died because, yes, that was a really bad typographical error in my diabetes instruction booklet.
Right, and to, I guess, make it clear, the instruction booklet said it was 20 grams instead of 2, which it actually is, right?
Right, that little bit of avocado. And it's what people think, like 1 degree change in temperature doesn't, That can't mean much, but it's actually 1 degree Celsius, which a lot of people in the U.S. don't understand that Celsius degrees are different than Fahrenheit degrees. And 1 degree is a huge amount. And you understand that if something gets off in your body, a part of the body connection I'm trying to make also is that if the external conditions are off, then the internal, our bodies are an extension of that. So we reflect what's going on out there, and it it does affect us. So if we want to make our bodies healthy, we have to keep supporting the health of all that's around us. We're part of it.
Certainly. And just to play off of that as well, I mean, you, as you learn to, I guess, cope, if that's the right word, or mm-hmm. learn to live with your diabetes, I mean, it seems like you become more acclimated to it, and you learn how to read your body and the feelings that it's giving off, or the what you're feeling too. So, I mean, I wonder if that's a connection we could make to kind of understanding the environment as well.
That's part of why I call it a gift, because I think I'm doing a better job just hearing my body since it spoke so loudly at that point. Almost died that day. Of course, there are several days I've almost died, and I guess we all collect those days. They are ones that teach us really important things. And this is a way that climate change is also kind of a gift. Because once we wake up to it, we really have to pay attention and switch our entire mindset. I think most of us have been born into or educated into a mindset of individualism, like I'm a separate thing and I just need to take care of my separate thing, and what happens around me doesn't really matter that much. I can ignore it. And also that we get to use everything. Everything else is a resource for me. And that we can conquer most anything. And those ideas kind of need to fall away when you realize that you are not a separate thing. You really are just part of a whole mesh of things. And little changes make a big difference. And we can't adapt to or recover from the catastrophic trajectory we're on without paying pretty close attention and changing our vision so that we begin to see with soft eyes. Or that I don't know if that image works. I learned to walk in the woods in a way that I learned later Native people often do. By not focusing, but by using the edges of my eyes to walk in the woods at night in the dark. By using the edges instead of the center point. And that's kind of what we need to do to find our way out of our current situation, is pay attention to all the edges and don't focus so sharply. I might not be right about that. I'm certainly not right in all cases, but I think it helps to practice that.
Well, and it certainly seems like it's a way of changing a perspective, not in a way of you need to change this to make it better or worse. It's just to change it, right? And yeah. This really sticks out in a lot of the meditations that you go into. And before we really get into the content of those, I just kind of wanted to ask you, like, where did you have the idea of putting the meditations throughout the chapters? And like, I guess, where did you come up with that? And then how did you decide where each meditation should go? Is that like a very intentional process?
Well, first, I'm a teacher, and there's nothing as bad in teaching as just lecturing all the time. I'm a teacher who knows that I learned most of what I know from listening to my students and to everything else. So if I was going to write a book, I didn't want it to be one where I did all the talking. Now, that's hard when you're writing a book because you have to write all the pages. But the meditations are pauses where I hope the reader will participate in creating the document. I used to tell students that they really hadn't read a book if they hadn't written all over it. You got to make it your own by writing in the margins, by engaging in a conversation with that person who's doing all the talking in the book. So That's part of it. Some of them grew out of assignments that I'd give my students. And then for where they came in the book, it's kind of a meditative process to decide. I wrote it in strands. So I wrote, and the strands I wrote in different places. So I wrote the parts about the watersheds in Minnesota up here at the lake where I am now. I'm looking out at that lake as I speak to you. I think I took a week or two up here by myself. And then there were various other times when I wrote that. I wrote my student stories, which were in many ways the hardest. They're painful, many of them. When I was on a writing retreat in California, and I was in community, I felt like I was being held in a community, and I could write those there. I wrote the diabetes things in St. Paul, but I'm close to my endocrinologist, where I would be safe if I needed to get to the emergency room. And I probably wrote the meditative things on the train, going back and forth from campus. I think we write and are, we write different things and we are different beings depending upon our setting. So it's kind of important to pick the setting for what you want to write or express. And then I wove them together. I had a great editor who said, you got all these different books here. Now make them into one thing, braid them. So one Thanksgiving weekend, I cut them all up and laid them on the floor and I braided them. That was really fun. That was the funnest part probably of writing, was braiding and letting the different parts call to each other. And I hope they went to places where they like being.
Yes, yes. And it was really beautiful the way that you did weave it together. And I can only imagine that part of the process after going through all of the work of writing these different sections in these different places, it would have been just so gratifying to be able to just put everything together. And it feels like it flows together so very well. And to kind of get into the content of the meditations, I think the most powerful one for me was just talking about how to die and really kind of submitting to different situations and how different people react to different scenarios and different levels of pain and trauma and difficulty. I don't know. I would like to hear your perspective on that.
It's an important one, I think. Early in the book, I talk about when this guy came into my classroom with a gun wanting to shoot one of my students. And everybody in the class thought that they were likely to die. It was one of those early gun incidents in an academic setting. And nobody died. So I'm giving away something from the drama of the story by telling you that, but not that day. The students who had the most difficulty were the ones who had never thought that they would ever be in a situation like that. The ones who did the best were the ones who had considered that something like that might happen. And that seemed really significant to me, that the people who managed best were the ones who actually could think of it and face it. Then there was a point in my diabetes diagnosis when I thought I might actually have pancreatic cancer instead, and that I would probably not live long. Actually, facing that was really helpful to me too, because I do know that if there's, I don't know, if I get caught in a fire up here and I don't have insulin, I do now know how to eat to keep myself alive for several weeks, maybe without insulin. But long term, it wouldn't work at all. So I'd have to figure out, like, how am I going to face this fact of dying? And it's been my experience that people do it maybe with less trauma if they've thought it through. And I think that we all need to think that through. My students whose family members are back in a position where they don't have enough food, or it's way too hot and they don't have any way to cool themselves, do better if they have felt through the inevitability of death and considered how they want to meet it. I don't know that I'll meet it the way I want to when I do, but I have a little better chance of meeting it in that way, or in some sensible, calm way, if I've considered it. This is a part of my ongoing work. Something else I know you were going to ask me about. My lake is that I'm looking out at. Underneath it is the ores, copper nickel ore, which is very rare on Earth. They're very rare metals. And we have one of the richest lodes of this right here under the lake and leading into the Boundary Waters Wilderness. There's a lot of political activity to prevent copper nickel mining from happening right under this lake or in areas very close to the Boundary Waters, where the waters flow in. The argument is that actually they're going to flow into the Mississippi, not into the Boundary Waters, but it's like, very narrow line, a few inches between those two watersheds. And in many places, they, like in my hometown, they overlap the two watersheds. That is a very important political issue. But what many people ignore is the fact that we already have waters with high sulfate concentration. Because when you do taconite mining, taconite is low-grade iron ore. My hometown, Babbitt, is a taconite mining town. When you do taconite mining, you are crushing the rocks that have sulfate ores mixed into them. And then as the water leaches through that, particularly after the mines are closed, it creates mine pit lakes with very high sulfate content. Wild rice can't grow in waters with more than, I believe this is what they've decided, 10 parts per million. And we've got water with more than 1,000 parts that leaches out into areas that used to be wild rice beds. Sulfate waters are not really good for anybody. They cause diarrhea in humans. I think they probably do in moose as well. I haven't spoken to any moose about that, but I expect so. It's not a great thing. And half of our lakes have high sulfate content already here in this part of Minnesota. That is not getting the kind of attention it needs. We need to fix that. And people are working on ways of actually using biological and natural methods to take the sulfate out of the water so that wild rice can grow again. Wild rice is central to the, of central importance to the Anishinaabe people here. It's holy. It is its own being. And the water also is. We need to protect the water and focus on the complexity of the issue. It isn't as simple as not letting something happen. That's important. But also noticing what we've already got to deal with is important. I think that's what I want to say about that. And I was at a meeting this morning talking about that issue, how we can bring together the many sides of people in this area and in all the watersheds. I actually don't like so much the state boundaries. I want us to talk more about the watershed boundaries. So I was looking and seeing that in Wyoming, I guess you have 6 watersheds. I think they all flow into the Missouri and the Yellowstone and then into the Mississippi.
Yes. And then there's some that goes into the Snake as well. That goes into the Columbian, I think.
It goes where as well? You might have to type that so I can hear.
Into the Columbian River.
Okay, the Columbia. Oh, yeah. So that would go west.
Right. And then we do have the Green River goes into the Colorado River.
Okay. So you've got three directions as well.
Yes.
That is really important and exciting because when we've got the water, all of ours in Minnesota comes from the sky and then it goes in three different directions. We're really responsible. We are water keepers and responsible. We get it pretty nicely from the rain, and how we send it on is very important. And it's really exciting to me to realize that you've got that same situation.
Yeah, you're right. It's a real responsibility, and it does take more than just one individual to really be able to cultivate the kind of solution to these problems that are already here. And it really does ring, especially after our conversation, but even just in reading the book, it really does ring true that you can't, just like a disease like diabetes, you just can't ignore it.
No.
Or else, you know, it just gets worse, right?
Yeah. Something that a lot of the indigenous people are doing and then inviting the rest of us to do too, is become water walkers, to walk the extent, see where the water falls outside your house. And then if you can, walk it all the way to the ocean, because it all goes there. And we are responsible for the health of the ocean. And to really learn the path of that water is quite powerful.
Yeah, that is, I don't know, that's truly beautiful in itself. And I think probably a good place to leave off, but because we have taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, you have kind of hinted at it, but I would like to just follow up and ask our traditional final question about, like, what are you working on now?
Yeah, well, I am working on establishing my home base here up in this watershed and leaving the city. I'm becoming a outstate Minnesotan again. I am also becoming a resident of Seattle. So your Columbia, send it on nicely to my kids and my family out there. And I'm working on these political and cultural divides, trying to find ways of talking among the various groups and helping people learn to become really grounded in the areas where they live. I do a lot of that on my webpage. I have a nice cartoon there about the connection between diabetes and climate that you could look at. I didn't have pictures put into the book, so it's on the webpage instead. And then wanting to encourage people like you, Matthew, to continue in the work you're doing, because it's going to take us all to go around to a world that's becoming healthier instead of becoming sicker. But we can make that switch.
I sure hope so. And before we go, where will people find you? What is your website?
My website is reneehansen.com. So it's R-A-N-A-E. Hansen is H-A-N-S-O-N.com.
Perfect. Well, everybody should go out and check out not only Watershed, but your website as well. Thank you so much for doing this interview. This has been such an honor. Thank you again.
And an honor for me. Thank you very much.